process and the
I guess I'll send and have a candy bar.
I know, where do these candies come from?
Get
sandy.
Oh,
but green.
Do you not want?
No, no. I want to know who to. I want to know who to thank.
I call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this February 13th. I'm going to step out of order very briefly. I'm going to open up two hearings to allow two of our members who are supposed to be sitting next door in a committee meeting to do their testimony first, and then I'll close those hearings and open them back up in the proper order later. So to begin with, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2723 and invite Representative Solman to introduce the bill for us.
Chair Greenlick and members of the Health Care Committee, thank you so much for having me testify in favor of this bill. My name is Janine Solman. I am the state representative from House District 30. I am here and today in support of House Bill 2723, which would remove the exclusion of hippotherapy or equine therapy from the Oregon Health Plan. This is a very effective tool for kids with autism, cerebral palsy, developmental delays, and many more. This is a bill that is that my good friend and former House District Representative Joe Gallegos worked very hard on. He was very passionate about this, and I was happy to chief sponsor this bill. I won't speak long, but I do believe there are concerns regarding and kind of questioning the whether this is an evidence-based type of form of therapy. I've submitted numerous reports to the committee that show record that this is a provided the peer-reviewed evidence of the successes of hippotherapy. And just this afternoon, my staff emailed you with a bibliography of all the peer-reviewed journals that provide enough evidence that show me that this is an effective use of therapy when sessions can be provided on a regular basis, hence the need for coverage. Hippotherapy should be considered merely another tool in the toolbox for therapists when developing a treatment plan specifically for their patient. I strongly believe that healthcare is a right for all and should not be a privilege for some. And having this exclusion has affected a lot of families and forced kids to stop their treatment due to costs. This form of therapy serves a broad range of patients, such as kids, stroke victims, and veterans. A dear friend and coworker, Karen Bomar, has been deeply affected by this exclusion and has shared her personal story that has been submitted as written testimony. I hope that you'll read her story, and I want you to know there are many more families such as hers. I think this is a beneficial type of therapy and should be accessible to everyone, and I hope that you will join me in supporting House Bill 2723. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Diego.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I just want to say that I'm so happy that the state continues to be represented by such attractive representatives. Chair Representative Greenlick, Vice Chair Representative Hayden, Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joseph Gallegos. I am the owner of Western Research Associates, a social research and development consulting firm. I'm also professor emeritus at the University of Portland, where I retired after 35 years with an academic career. My training was in psychiatric social work with doctoral study in cross-cultural mental health, postdoc in mental health research. Some might refer to me as a so-called expert, but it is this background, with this background, that I speak in support of this bill. I suspect that all of us have family, friends, or acquaintances who suffer perhaps from intellectual or developmental disabilities, maybe a military veteran, or a victim of domestic violence, or even a recently arrived refugee. All of these and many more run the risk of suffering from long-term long-term trauma. Trauma-informed care has become somewhat of a buzzword in the human services field, and not without reason. We know that the mental health community and mental health and physical stress, especially toxic stress, cause long-lasting effects of the trauma. We also know that the growing field of animal-assisted therapy has demonstrated a significant contribution to the reduction of deleterious effects of that trauma. My own alma mater, University of Denver, actually has an international master's program that awards a certificate in animal-assisted therapy. As you will hear from those testifying after me, practitioners in the field, this is not unproven science. The bill addresses the need for better access and better practice, or best practice health and mental health intervention. Scientific merits aside, it is in a time when our citizens are being particularly traumatized by a fear of loss of access to health care. This bill would expand access to some of our most vulnerable citizens. The bill seeks to strike the exclusion of hippotherapy from the Oregon Health Plan. However, the intent is more broadly meant to recognize both the physical and mental therapeutic value of this intervention. I believe there is an amendment coming that would clarify this broader intent. My colleagues from the field can speak more directly to those aspects. For now, I just encourage you, the committee, to support the bill, proceed to work in the bill, and send it onto the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Any questions? If there's hard questions, my colleague will be happy to answer.
See Joe.
I think we're going to close the hearing now. We'll get back to it a bit later, and we'll be asking questions.
All right.
And I hope you'll hang around to watch this so we can call you back.
I'm going to go to my next committee across the hallway, but if I need to come back, I certainly will do so.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to close the public hearing to be reopened later, the public hearing on House Bill 2723, and open again for the same purpose. Public hearing on House Bill 2432. You hear from Representative Parrish, then we'll close that one again and get back into order. Welcome, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, West Lynn and Tualatin, bringing you House Bill 2432 that's sponsored with Senator Dembro. Those of you who were on the committee in 2015 might remember that Merrill Hurst University, which is in my district, has a variety of different therapy licenses that they actually work really hard to help people get their degrees in, and then those degrees haven't necessarily always been recognized by the state of Oregon, and certainly not at some point down the road for the purpose of being able to bill insurance. I don't normally love more licensing, but I think when we have a challenge of a profession that is having access to reimbursements and payments and being recognized within a profession, then that's an appropriate time to have a conversation about licensure. So similarly drafted to how we did the music therapy licensing in 2015. This bill is around art therapy. It's going to get a couple tweaks, and you're going to hear about that from the proponent, so I will let them sort of walk you through what this is. But this has basically been set up the same, almost the exact same way we set up the music therapy program in 2015. Where rather than having their own board, art therapists would be licensed under the Oregon Health Licensing Association.
Office.
There we go, whatever their alphabet soup is this year. But they would be set up under them. They would not have their own board. At some point in the future, when they had enough people to merit a board, we would come back some other session and have that conversation. But for right now, we would just license them through OLA. And then the industry themselves, along with the university, has sort of scripted what art therapy is. One of the amendments that you're going to see, and actually there's probably a dash one and a dash two. We're going to roll it into a dash three. But one of the amendments has to do with other licensed therapy who does art as part of this, but they don't call themselves art therapists. But we want to make sure that they are not precluded from using art in their other licensed practices. So you'll see that. And then, like I said, the proponents of the bill had some negotiated language that they kind of worked out. They had a couple tweaks in here that they wanted to do. And so there's some folks who've worked on an amendment, and we'll just try to roll it all together into one. But it's really pretty much what we did in 2015 for music therapists. We're doing that for art therapists so that they can be a recognized profession for the purpose of not just this is what the industry is, but also how they would be billed, able to bill for insurance at some point in the future.
Okay, great. Well, we'll be hearing from, I think, quite a few folks.
Yes, it's a laundry list on there. I saw that. So anyway, thank you. I'm going to zip back to committee unless there's any other questions.
Back to work.
I'll go back to work. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Parrish. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2432. We've got tons of witnesses on all the bills. I'm going to ask all the witnesses today to try and be very, very brief. We'll try and get as many folks in as we can. We'll end a quarter to five, or maybe we'll spill a few minutes over, but there's a lot of work to do. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2339. Madam Administrator, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2339 comes to you at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It prohibits non-participating facility-based providers and provider in emergency cases from balance billing. It requires insurers to pay non-participating facility-based providers a reasonable and customary payment rate, and that the rate be based on statistically credible information that is updated at least annually. It also requires the insurer and healthcare service contractor to have a dispute resolution process for resolving reimbursement disputes for the non-participating providers. Mr. Chair, we have Laura Callie Robison from DCBS and Tasha Sample from DCBS. And boy, oh boy, are they right there.
Yeah. And this bill has a long way to go. So this bill and the next bill we'll be working on for a while. But let's get the public hearings out of the way and see what's on our mind. Is this the one we have folks on the phone for?
Yes, but not until after.
Not yet.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Please go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Knows, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Callie Robison. I'm the administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm also joined by Tasha Sample, who's a senior policy analyst with our division, and you'll be hearing from her in a few more minutes as we talk about some of the details of the bill. I'm here today to talk to you about House Bill 2339. This is a bill proposed by DCBS to address the issue of balance billing or surprise billing, something that you know some of you may have heard from your constituents about over the years. But what it is, it's the practice of consumers going to seek services out of network or seeking services and then being billed for the difference between an out-of-network reimbursement from their insurer and the amount.
Seeking services from an in-network provider.
Well, I'll get to a couple more specific explanations about different ways this comes about. But basically, a consumer goes to seek services, and it turns out that there are out-of-network charges incurred. And what happens is the insurer pays the out-of-network reimbursement rate. There's a cost sharing that usually applies to out-of-network services. And then in these circumstances, the providers then send a bill for the difference between their billed charges and what is being paid by the insurer as the out-of-network charge. So this is currently allowed under our laws. And so what happens is that consumers might receive bills, some of them relatively small, some of them can be pretty significant. And if they don't pay them, they can be sent to collections or sometimes put on a payment plan. To talk a little bit about where this happens and why it happens, we have three common scenarios just to give you a flavor of how this might arise. So one example is a planned surgery. So the consumer is trying to do their homework, identifies a surgeon and a hospital that's in network, and then there could be services that surround that surgery, the labs or potentially certain providers that they actually don't have the ability to research up front that are out of network and then contribute to those bills. You might have other instances that don't have anything to do with the surgery where a lab test may be provided by an in-network lab but then sent to an out-of-network processor. And there also can be emergency situations that lead to this. This is really something that can impact anyone at any time, at any age. And I think it's really important to note that these are common issues that come to us. From about from the beginning of 2014 until September of last year when we started to work on this, we had 54 complaint files that were directly related to balance billing. And we had 280 complaint files that were related to emergency services and the copays that would align with that. I mentioned before that sometimes these can be pretty small issues. So, you know, we have examples of just a dispute over, you know, maybe $100, which may be small to some people, may not be as small to others, but that's kind of on the low end of what we might see. Sometimes this can be several thousands of dollars that consumers are receiving bills for that they weren't anticipating. So that I just wanted to frame out kind of the scope of what we're dealing with, and then I'm going to ask Tasha to talk through a little bit more about what the bill does to address that problem.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, and Vice Chair Nose. My name is Tasha Sample. I'm a Senior Policy Analyst at the Division of Financial Regulation. When we drafted this bill, we wanted to address surprise billing based on what we had learned from other states who have done similar surprise billing legislation. So we wanted to prohibit billing for amounts above the applicable copayment, coinsurance, or deductible. We wanted to define an out-of-network reimbursement rate. We also looked into requiring insurers to establish a dispute resolution process for non-participating facility-based providers, which are just providers who are contracted with a hospital but do not carry contracts with insurers. We wanted to also hold consumers harmless from surprise billing or any negotiations that may happen between insurers and providers. And we wanted to also prohibit retaliation against providers who use the dispute resolution process. After drafting the draft of House Bill 2339 that is before the committee today, the department also considered concepts from other states, including Washington, New York, Connecticut, Illinois, and Texas. We also considered changes to recent federal marketplace legislation or federal marketplace regulations around emergency room services. We also met with a stakeholder advisory committee twice in September and October. And while the committee could agree that balance billing was a significant issue that faced consumers, they could not agree on a solution of how to fix surprise billing or balance billing. Topics discussed during the meeting included the scope of surprise billing, reimbursement rate methodology, the dispute resolution process, and network adequacy. So they were very robust meetings. The department also received feedback on a November 28th conference call from some providers that we met with that were also part of the stakeholder advisory committee. And we also looked into use of the Oregon All Payer All Claims database to establish a reimbursement rate. And we also looked at a Fair Health database out of New York to establish a reimbursement rate. We are proposing an amendment to address the issues raised during the advisory committee, including the dispute resolution process and ongoing discussion related to reimbursement rates. That concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Hack?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of came in late on this, but thank you. Sounds like you did a lot of work. Could you tell us who, you said you had some stakeholders and folks that met a couple of different times. Could you tell us a little bit about who those were?
Absolutely. Chair Greenlick, Representative Hack, we tapped our insurance stakeholders, so the insurers and representative from insurance companies. We also worked with some provider organizations. We reached out to the Oregon Medical Association. We worked with some emergency room physicians groups, as well as an anesthesiology group. Finally, we tried to reach out to consumers that we have worked with in the past, and we worked specifically with Osprig to get the consumer feedback on this bill.
Can I have a follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what was their response? Are all of these folks in agreeance with what you came up with, minus the amendments that you indicated?
Chair Greenlick.
That's a loaded question, isn't it?
That's a hard question to answer.
We'll be hearing from them.
We can let them speak for themselves, but they could not agree during the committee or during the advisory committee hearings.
A big issue.
It is a huge issue.
Yeah, I think part of the issue is not whether we ought to be doing it, but how much you ought to be paid. How much you ought to be paid. That seems to be the biggest issue. I expect you're going to get a
question.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Do you have a definition for reasonable and customary?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller. So that's actually the one of the issues that we are going to be completely changing in the amendment. So we're actually planning to remove the reference to usual and customary, and instead, you know, try to come up with an agreed upon way to reimburse those out of network charges. So that was certainly one of the concerns, is that has some difficulties in defining it, and I think also in terms of kind of whether that's the appropriate way to get at this issue.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're going to figure out how to make this thing work. Again, I'm going to ask all the witnesses to please try and hold the testimony in maybe 2 minutes. It'd be very helpful. We have a lot of work to do. Would you call the first panel?
Well, I will in a minute, Mr. Chair. We do have Robin Gilbound from Fair Health Incorporated and Michelle Scott from Fair Health Incorporated on the phone. And we will have a PowerPoint up, so they'll take just a minute to give their presentation.
Okay.
Okay. Is that correct, Robin? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Michelle is not on the line. I have some of my other colleagues. And I had, because of the time crunch, I was not going to go through the slides, but just make a brief statement. If you'd like me to refer to slides, I can do that.
No, I appreciate that. We'll put the slides in evidence.
Okay.
Testimony.
I mean, in the record.
Yeah, it's on all of us.
Go ahead.
Would you like to? Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robin Gilbert, and I am the president of Fair Health, a national, independent, not-for-profit organization. I'm providing informational testimony today about Fair Health and take no position on the pending legislation. We've been asked to provide informational testimony for lawmakers in many other states. They debate their balance billing legislation. So for those of you who don't know, Fair Health was created in 2009 out of an investigation brought by the Office of the New York Attorney General. It was focused on the adjudication of out-of-network claims, and our mission after the matter was settled was to bring clarity, transparency, and integrity to healthcare costs and health insurance information. We are completely conflict-free and unaffiliated with any insurer. In order to fulfill our mission, we disseminate robust data products to all stakeholders in the healthcare industry, including payers, hospitals, providers, as well as all other researchers and academic teachers and so forth. But our main goal is to provide a consumer platform that brings them educational resources and a cost estimator tool to help them navigate the healthcare system, which has been recognized by the White House and many other leaders. Our board of directors are uncompensated and nationally recognized in their respective areas of expertise, from the plan community, the provider community, consumer advocacy, law, and so forth. Our repository, which is the largest private healthcare claims collection in the country, includes over 23 billion records, which represents the healthcare claims experience for approximately 150 million covered lives. It includes both the billed, the non-negotiated fee-for-service amounts, as well as the allowed amount, the negotiated contract amount. The data are organized into 483 geographic regions. In Oregon alone, we have more than 134 million records. In addition to our private healthcare claims collection, we are one of only four organizations around the country who have been designated by CMS as a qualified entity, which means that we are entitled to receive all of Parts A, B, and D Medicare data for all 50 states, including Oregon, and we use that data to help inform and validate the data that we have. Because of our independence and the fact that we have no conflict with any stakeholder in the industry, we have been approached by many states to serve as the benchmark for various health-related programs. So, for example, we serve as the benchmark to support workers' comp fee schedules in many states, auto liability. We've been written into the California Health Code for emergency services. We support dispute resolution programs for neurologically impaired newborns, for disabled children in Arizona, so on and so forth. And relevant to this hearing today, we have been factored into consumer protection laws involving balanced billing in both New York and Connecticut. and have been approached by many, many other states right now who are doing what you're doing, which is deliberating fully the path that their state should take with respect to balanced billing legislation. I should note that we do not set UCR rates ourselves. What we do is offer an array of percentiles for all procedures that are recognized in the CPT code book. We offer percentiles from the 5th to the 95th. So it is up to the state or the stakeholder to determine what percentile that works best for their jurisdiction, whether it's a percentile of charged data or a multiple of allowed data, for that matter. When we do make our data available to states to support a legislative solution, it's typically there is no cost to the states. We make the data available for free to the states, and then it becomes really of no major cost to any stakeholder. And our website is completely free for consumers, so they can easily access the information.
Can I interrupt you a moment? How precisely would you see your work fitting into this bill?
I'm sorry?
How precisely would you see your data fitting into this bill?
Well, the way in which Fair Health has factored into the bill is in different ways. So, for example, in New York, they created a codified term called usual and customary costs, which they defined in the statute as the 80th percentile of an independent database unaffiliated with any insurer that is designated by the Secretary of the Department of Financial Services. Thereafter, in the specific official memoranda, the Secretary of DSS designated Fair Health as the only data source in New York that met that definition. And the way it works in New York is that plans are not required to reimburse providers for surprise out-of-network bill or emergency services at the 80th percentile, but the 80th percentile becomes a benchmark that serves as a backdrop to discussions, hoping that the parties will come to some resolution amongst themselves. If they do not agree, and in the most instances they do agree, but if they do not agree, it then goes to a certified dispute resolution process that's specifically set forth in the statute. And the certified dispute resolution entity is expressly authorized to look to UCC, that is the 80th percentile of our database, as one of the factors to use to settle the matter. My understanding is after 1 year in New York law, there were less than 300 disputes that were brought to the dispute resolution entity. For the most part, the parties agreed. They may not have agreed at the 80th percentile, depending on who the parties were. They could have agreed at the 50th, the 60th. It was their decision. So when it did go to the dispute resolution process, it was relatively evenly split whether it was the plans or the providers that prevailed.
I think we're going to need to ask you to wrap it up. We're going to need to move on.
Okay, yes, so that concludes my remarks, unless there are any questions.
I have one.
Go ahead, Rob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I get from your testimony that you're an entity that sort of helps states figure out how to do this. Do you have an opinion about whether this is a good bill or a bad bill?
We are completely neutral. That's why we have been brought in by states. We don't take a position, but we offer guidance and education about different ways in which our data can be used and inform states based on other conversations we had with other states. So we do not take a position. We are, you know, really, we just want the stakeholders to make a decision that's right for their jurisdiction.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, briefly, please.
So are you an entity that we would contract with rather than using the Department of Consumer and Business Services to do this?
When you say contract with for guidance on the bill or contract with for the data itself?
I assume the data.
So as I said, for the data itself, when we are referred to in the statute, it is at no cost. I mean, it is at no cost to the state. They will refer to us in either the official guidance memoranda or regulation or statute, most of the payers already license our data to help adjudicate the non-surprise out-of-network claims, so they have access to our data. Consumers have access to it for free, and physicians have easy access to it through a website that we offer that just has an administrative fee to access. So there is no fee. It's budget neutral to the state.
Well, you'll be hearing from us as we move along on this bill. I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to disconnect now, Robin.
Wherever
just
that.
Do it.
Well, there we go.
Call the first panel, please.
Okay. Jesse O'Brien, John Bartholomew, and Chris Allman.
Briefly.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPERG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer advocacy group. I will be as brief as I can. I did submit detailed written remarks. OSPERG strongly supports this bill. As I'm sure you'll be hearing, there are a number of important details that still need to be worked out. Issue is really a very pressing issue for consumers in Oregon, along with prescription drug costs. This is the single issue that I get the most communication from our members about, because it's just such an outrageous situation when this happens to someone who's done everything right. If I had a bit more time, I would share a number of consumer stories with you. I'll just mention one really briefly from an OSPERG member named Bob, who told me that he was actually aware that this was something that could happen to you. He scheduled a knee replacement surgery months in advance and checked to make sure that every provider involved was in-network. And then on the day of the surgery, the in-network anesthesiologist called in sick, was replaced without notifying him, and he was unconscious at the time. So he received a balance bill of several thousand dollars. So even if you know that this is an issue, try to do the right thing. It's just not possible with the way the rules work today. So we recognize that the stakeholders are a ways apart on this bill, but I think it's really critical that we get folks to the table to agree on a compromise. I think this bill is a great starting point for conversation. We strongly support its emphasis on ensuring that consumers are held harmless and not required to pay more than the in-network rate in these situations. And for consumers, it's most critical to ensure that the rules banning surprise balance bills are clear and enforceable. The specific details of the reimbursement rate are much less critical, as long as it's within a reasonable range so that it does not lead to dramatically increased premiums or reduced access or other kinds of problems that create downstream issues for consumers. We don't have a specific position on what the reimbursement rate or the procedure for figuring out the reimbursement rate should be, but we do believe that it's critical that it be clearly defined and transparent for all parties.
Wrap it up, sir.
Yes, very quickly. So the other thing I would just mention really quickly is we're a little bit concerned that the draft as introduced, the bill as introduced, doesn't really have a plan for enforcing these protections. It's a little bit unclear from the language of the bill what actually happens if a consumer receives a balance bill in violation of this law after it passes. We think it's critical to make sure that consumers in those situations are not subject to debt collection or damage to their credit rating, and that if they pay a bill that they're not liable to pay under this law, they have the ability to recoup these funds. So I hope we can clarify that in the discussion over this bill going forward. So I can leave it there for now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlake and members of the Healthcare Committee, my name is Chris Allman. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about this very, very important issue. And I'm very appreciative that Fair Health spoke ahead of time, because my testimony includes some examples of how Fair Health looks at pricing. And what I would like to say is I share Dr. Buehler's concerns about what is reasonable and customary. And I should point out that QCOR just put out a report on regional cost comparisons, and Oregon ranked highest when it came to overall price index. So when we have the what the market will bear pricing, then you have to really wonder, how do you create a fair reimbursement? But the other thing that I want to point out, because it's real clear that it's falling, causing patients to have medical bankruptcy. That's a problem overall that we're not dealing with this. But if you under-reimburse, because, like I say, it could be based on usual UCR, and that's on a percentage basis. It could be based on Medicare pricing. The vast range of ways that reimbursement can be put back could mean that a doctor would be grossly under-reimbursed. And in that regard, then, where especially you have salaried physicians, and that's more and more, primary care docs, the pressures may be that they will be on the wheel, you know, running that much more, seeing lots of patients, not getting the time they need. I think one of the problems that we have to address is what we're doing with pricing. I really, really urge that we look at Maryland to deal with this issue of setting caps on hospital costs and setting rates. And I will always make a plug for doing single-payer financing. So, because I feel that this is all just, this is insurance companies that are doing financial engineering with limiting networks.
Wrap it up.
And that's it.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. We are here to support the principle behind 2339, knowing that more work needs to be done on really figuring out what is that fair reimbursement rate, as well as the issues that Mr. O'Brien mentioned regarding enforceability of the law if it was passed. I have heard stories of this, of the surprise billing, from numerous people, whether it's friends or members of AARP all across the state. I'll tell you my story very briefly. I went to a doctor who said I need an MRI. He referred me to somebody who was within the same organization, the same health system. I double-checked to see that it was definitely in network, and to figure out what is my cost going to be for this MRI. Everything went smoothly. And then about a month later, I received a bill for about $750, which was way above what I was supposed to be doing. Turned out it was from the subcontracted person who they subcontracted with to read the MRI, which I didn't even know that they subcontracted that kind of thing out. They never informed me that that was the case. You know, in my case, I argued with my insurance company for a couple of months. I eventually, you know, won that and they paid the bill. But from my understanding, a lot of people end up with thousands of dollars of debt who are less able to pay that than I was at the time. So, you know, it's happened to me. It's happened to thousands of other people. And we urge you to work this out so that we can have something that does hold the consumers harmless when they do the right thing and believe that they are getting services in their health insurance network.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Can you call the next panel, please?
John Moorhead, Dan Bissell, Mark Norling.
Maybe the next
and on
ready.
Deck.
Yeah. On deck is Jessica Adamson, Elise Brown, Tom Holt, and Doug Barber. That finishes up, Mr. Chair.
Good. In any order, guys.
Thank you. I'll go ahead. Chair Greenick, members of the committee, I'm John Moorhead. I'm a practicing emergency physician. I'm the past president and member of the board of the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians. I'm also past president of the Oregon Medical Association and speaking for them here as well. I don't want to read. I've given you written testimony, and I think you understand what balance billing is. Unfortunately, 2339 as written and with the proposed amendments is well-intentioned as written. It's not going to accomplish the goals and objectives that may and also may result in some unintended consequences, which may jeopardize patients' access to care. We need a solution that's transparent, that everyone can understand, and provide fair coverage for patients. I would remind us all that federal EMTALA laws were passed at the urging of emergency physicians who saw patients turned away in acute care situations due to inability to care. And emergency physicians are proud to serve as part of the safety net for patients. This is part of our social obligations to our communities. Unfortunately, insurance companies take advantage of that obligation by arbitrarily reimbursing us for services at below market rates without a negotiated contract. Balanced billing affects more than emergency physician, and it affects all providers that are as defined as facility-based, who we use as consultants, anesthesiologists, radiologists, pathologists, surgeons, trauma surgeons, folks that we are on our call panel that we consult with in the emergency department to meet our federal obligation of evaluating and stabilizing patients. Everyone agrees that the problem needs to be fixed upstream. The target should be address outliers to the system, not to overturn the existing contracting system. The key challenge, as you've spoken to, Chair Greenlick, is determining what fair reimbursement is, and we appreciate the presentation from Fair Health because we think that provides a basis for appropriate reimbursement. Patients have to be taken out of the middle. Insurance companies must be transparent about how they calculate payments and provide fair coverage for emergency patients. The simple solution, there's been a proposal, a simple solution to just tie rate of reimbursement to out-of-network providers to a percentage of Medicare. In effect, this will greatly discount payments to providers. 175% of reimbursement under Medicare, which is in one of the in proposed amendments, would cut reimbursement to providers by over 50% in many cases. Many OMA surveys have been done about practicing physicians' ability to manage patients who are currently covered with Medicare, and we find more and more physicians, even under elective situations, who are not able to keep their doors open to Medicare payments due to Medicare patients due to rate of reimbursement. We need a reimbursement, as you've heard, that based on actual, usual, customary, as Representative Bueller questioned. We don't want patients caught in the middle. We don't want any outlier charges, and that was the original 10 of the negotiations that we've been involved in. Our consulting specialists need to be adequately reimbursed to remain on our call panel and available to patients in the emergency department. Just to put in context, most emergency physician bills are in the range of $250 to $300. The mediation process that you've had in other states who've implemented apply for charges above $500 and only apply to a very, very small percentage of emergency charges. The vast majority would be covered in an under $500 sort of range. Just ask you for the opportunity. As you've talked about, there's more work to be done. We're going to hopefully hold hearings. There's other balanced billing legislation we understand that will be introduced, and if a work group is convened, we'd like to participate and hope that there will be equal numbers of consumers, insurance, and providers. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, honored members of the committee. Thank you for letting me come today and add my group's voice to this conversation. My name is Dan Bissell, and I represent Northwest Acute Care Specialists. As their president and CEO, I'm also a full-time practicing emergency physician. Our group is the largest independent emergency physician group in Oregon, with over 150 providers treating over a quarter million patients a year. I hope to use my testimony to maybe lend some perspective to the balance billing issue that may be somewhat unique to emergency medicine and build on Dr. Moorhead's testimony. First, let me start by saying we, like everybody who's come before me today, wholeheartedly support collaborative initiatives to address balanced billing, because nobody should have to decide whether they're in-network or out-of-network, particularly when they face an emergency situation. But we also feel that this has to be done in a fair, clear, and transparent way, and there's still work to be done to establish that system. From our perspective, as the largest independent group in Oregon, we enjoy a portfolio of contracts with virtually every payer in the region, and we work hard to maintain that portfolio of contracts because we see that as the best business opportunity to establish long-term relationships. In fact, over the last 2 years, we've developed multi-year contracts with payers. Balanced billing is a tiny percentage of what happens in our business. We see over 260,000 patients a year, and in 2016, less than 3% of patients ended up with balanced bill. And the majority of those cases were actually out-of-state payers that didn't have any regional representation here. And we work with patients and with the payers to resolve those issues. So from the emergency physician standpoint, these issues are important, but also not predominant. Furthermore, as John pointed out, our charges amount to a few hundred dollars, much less than the multi-thousand dollar charges associated with other procedures and other scenarios when balanced billing comes into play. Emergency physicians are also somewhat unique given the realities of EMTALA. We're federally mandated to see every single patient that comes through the door, no matter their ability to pay, no matter the problem. We pride ourselves on that fact, in fact. But that means that ultimately we have to balance the reality that two-thirds of our patients are uninsured or underinsured with the ability to generate revenue from insured patients and allow us to maintain a practice and a business. Specialists and on-call panels are an essential part of the emergency care safety network, and we have to work together to provide that essential safety network that we as a culture and a community depend on. The proposed legislation would essentially represent a 50% pay cut to where we are today. In that scenario, having to see every patient that comes through the door, no matter their ability to pay, inevitably the insurers would no longer want to contract with groups because the cheapest option would be to be out of network. Mm. In that scenario, then, providers would suddenly face a substantial pay cut, and likely we would have difficulty recruiting or even retaining the providers that we have. Emergency physicians are uniquely portable in our practice in that we don't have established referral patterns or requirements. We see everybody that comes before us, and therefore emergency physicians are in high demand. They may likely go to other parts of the country. We support the efforts to end balanced billing and to address it in a meaningful way, and we think that can be done by addressing this fair and reasonable practice. We feel that the ability to enter and exit into contracts is an essential part of parity in a healthy marketplace and retains sustainable business relationships. And by setting a reasonable out-of-network charge, we can retain the ability to establish the long and robust relationships we have with payers and serve both our patients mutually.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Mark Norling. I'm a practicing anesthesiologist in Portland. I work at Northwest Ambulatory Surgery Center. I'm also past president and still a current member of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. We're a group of about, well, over 600 physicians, and we work to uphold the highest standards of care and patient advocacy. We also promote research, education, and innovation in anesthesia care. I'm here to oppose House Bill 2339. I think we can all agree on the importance of protecting the patient from confusing and expensive out-of-network bills. But the solution proposed is in my view not the correct one. The Dash 1 amendments offered by DCBS specify that providers will be reimbursed at 175% of Medicare rates. And our society feels this solution is too simple for the complex problem we have before us. Medicare rates are political, usually quite low, and they're not market-based. In anesthesia, Medicare typically reimburses only about 33% of what a commercial insurer would. Tying reimbursement rates to a percentage of Medicare would boost the insurance company's profits, certainly, because they'll pay us quite less. But it could ultimately reduce access for patients. We feel a better solution to this balanced billing issue would be to tie reimbursement rates to a percentile of the Fair Health database, which you heard about earlier today. Fair Health is the only national database that's not-for-profit, transparent, and independent from insurance companies. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you all very much for coming down. I think we're hearing what you're saying, even though we're keeping you to a brief festival.
Thanks, thank you.
We're going to work something out. Thank you very much. Could you call the next panel, please?
Jessica Adamson, Elise Brown, Tom Holt, Doug Barber. But, yeah, you can slide in.
Somewhere you can, while you're thinking about this, can answer the question, why don't you just pay them the in-system rate? Would that be a problem?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Commissioner Calle described very well the scope of the issue here. It's the out-of-network provider practicing at an in-network facility, and they can get bills from several hundred to several thousand dollars. We looked at our data, and as the gentleman who was just up here said, it happens a very small percentage of the time. But when you're dealing with many, many, many claims, that adds up to a lot of consumers who are impacted. It is the number one pain point that our customers have identified to us that they get questions to HR departments about or to the broker who has sold the plan to an employer. We feel this is really important to resolve for our members because though we feel we do provide a fair reimbursement to out-of-network providers, inevitably many of these providers who are outliers. I want to emphasize we have most carriers locally have contracts with most providers, and I don't think any of us desire to have fewer under contract. But those who are not then tend to send, you know, the balance bill. What we're striving for on this issue is a solution that is predictable, transparent, protects the consumer, and by that I mean we would like to see the consumer have in-network level benefits as far as their out-of-pocket, so that they're not caught in the middle. But the art is going to be finding what the right level is so that we don't destabilize our ability to have networks. In answer to your question, Chair Greenlick, if we were to pay providers what our in-network rate is, it would be mighty comfy from a financial standpoint for a provider to say, I'm not going to bother with a contract. Then we would not have access to the data that we need to drive quality and better outcomes in care for our members in collaboration with the providers we have under contract. And, you know, technology has enabled a lot of progress just in the last few years in using that data in productive ways, and we don't want to lose that. So we have suggested a multiple of Medicare as a simple and transparent solution. Everyone knows what that number is then, whatever the number is determined to be as a multiple, and can be entirely predictable for the provider and for the payer, and our member doesn't have to get caught in the middle. We look forward to further discussions about this. We really do appreciate the work that DCBS has put into this. We've had large and vigorous discussions, and I think you've probably heard some common elements of, at least at a principal level, from all sides on this. I'll close in saying that we do not support using databases and having dispute resolution mechanisms. All that adds complexity to something. It doesn't have to be complex. We're dealing with a small number of outlier providers and a relatively small percentage of the claims.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. I would like to echo my colleague Tom Holt, who said very eloquently a lot of what we would have to say, so I won't repeat him in the interest of time, but would simply add a couple of points. First, to the question of why would we not just pay them the in-network rate? Providence is a population health company, is both a payer and a provider. We are moving and pushing in our insurance arrangements to do more value-based payments, outcome-based payments, to really push for value for the services provided as opposed to just a fee-for-service payment. Losing the ability to bring people into the network, to provide an incentive to come into our networks and produce those outcomes, it is hard work. It's work that we do together with our provider groups. It's important work, and just saying we're going to pay you what we'd pay others who are doing that work seems unfair to us. That said, in our data, looking both from our facility basis as well as our payer basis, the incidence of this is very small. It's not okay for us, for our consumers, to go through that because, frankly, when someone leaves one of our eight hospitals and they receive a balance bill, in the rare cases where that happens, they don't just associate it with that provider. They associate that with Providence as a whole, and that's not the patient experience that we want folks to have. Instead, what we really want are those providers to come into our network. We work very, very hard to make sure that the providers in our hospital are in the Providence network. Are in the networks for which we're a part. So we work very hard to avoid this, but want to see a solution that is simple, that avoids a costly and lengthy process for settling disputes. And finally, what's important to us, and Jesse from Osberg mentioned this, is ensuring that both consumers are out of the loop if there's are held harmless if a balance bill is sent when it shouldn't be, but additional provider accountability if that behavior occurs. There's responsibility on the payers here. There should be responsibility on the providers if that if the statute isn't followed, and that currently isn't part of the amendment discussion or part of the base bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and a welcome to all of you new members to the committee. America's Health Insurance Plans is the national association representing health insurance plans across the country. And short of saying ditto to what you just heard very eloquently, I'll just restate a couple things. AHIP and many of their Oregon members sat at the table. Thanks to DCBS for bringing this issue and bringing all the stakeholders together. We are committed, as many others, to address the issue and settle on a reasonable reimbursement amount in statute that doesn't put the market at risk of further destabilization. So we're committed to seeing this through, and we hope to get back to you with something that we can all agree on that truly benefits consumers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel.
I have a question.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you. We've got four more bills to deal with.
Just a quick point, though.
Go for it.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And any of you can answer this question. When you have a payment directed for services by an out-of-network provider, does that payment go to the patient or to the provider?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, we had a bill here a couple of years ago to specifically pay, I believe, surgery centers directly. I think that's our practice across the board. I'd be happy to look further into that, but I think that's the practice now.
That's my understanding about our practice as well. If I may add one just very quick point, I promise I'll take less than 30 seconds.
Because it didn't used to be. It didn't used to be your practice.
As I understand, we've made some changes in that, but I can do some further research. That's
great.
The information I received from our plan. One last point. There was a raising of concern by some that if the rate isn't quite fair enough, that we would just dump our entire networks and say everyone gets the lower rate. There is a law that you all passed last session, and we spent hours and hours working on dealing with network adequacy and saying that y'all need to have enough folks in your network to ensure that patients can actually use the insurance that they purchased and that it isn't long waits to get into network providers. So we view that piece of legislation.
30 seconds.
No, sorry. That piece of legislation helps to address that issue.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. We had insurance agents that were part of the DCBS work group because agents on surprise billing cases often become consumer advocates. That's who consumers call when they get that surprise bill. The agents believe that this needs to be solved in a way that is invisible to the policyholder. So whatever the solution is should be done up front so that the policyholder simply pays what they should pay under an in-network situation. We think the solution should be simple and predictable. Based on the conversations that we had in that work group, we thought that the best solution was some percentage of Medicare. I don't know what that percentage is, what the right number is, but if you do something that is simple and predictable, we don't think, given the small number of cases that they keep talking about, that there's a need for a complicated dispute resolution process, that if the solution is clear and predictable up front, it should be easy for the insurers and for the providers to know what they're going to get in and out of network, in-network situation. Thank you very much.
Doug, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2339 and open a brief public hearing on House Bill 2398. Madam Minister, what's this bill about?
House Bill 2398 comes to the House Health Care Committee at the request of the Oregon Law Center. This, too, is addressing the balance billing. This prohibits health care providers from billing medical assistant recipients except as provided by the Oregon Health Authority by rule. Requires health care providers to wait for the payment for 90 days before assigning the claim for the collection. We have, and would you like me to invite the folks? John Mullen for the Oregon Law Center, Courtney Dresser, and Nan Heim.
Let's try and keep this brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Are you
of the
retired?
Committee.
What are you doing here?
That's right. I flunked retirement the second time. So, pleasure to be here today. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. For those of you who are less familiar with the Oregon Law Center, just briefly, our mission is to achieve justice for Oregon's low-income communities by providing a full range of high-quality civil legal services. In that regard, we're here to talk about 2398, which involves improper billing of OHP clients. Some of you who are on the committee may remember we had a very brief discussion about this back in January of 2016 to identify the issue. And I would like to just very briefly refer to the testimony we submitted in 2016 because I think it sums it up very well. From Beth Englander, Legal Aid Services of Oregon and the Oregon Law Center have been working for years with clients who have OHP coverage when they receive medical or dental treatment, but who still get billed by their provider. Despite the fact that federal and state Medicaid law prohibits this, and there's a citation for that in my testimony, OHP clients are unable to stop the billing, which goes very quickly to collection agencies and regularly results in OHP clients being harassed by collection agencies, forced into court in order to pay a large medical debt that is financially devastating to them. So I would also say that we have there have been some changes. We have been working productively with the Oregon Health Authority. They are now more aggressively investigating these issues. But at last time we checked, there were still on the order of 357 billing issues that were unresolved that OHA is working on. So mainly we think that we still need some further improvement to the processes, and that's why we proposed this bill. And basically what we would like to be able to do is to stop this at the front end so that verification happens at the front end so that somebody who's on OHP does not get billed improperly. And then on the back end, if there is a billing, that it waits for a period of 90 days so that it doesn't go to collections immediately. If you're a low-income person and you have a credit problem, it's very difficult to get on with your life, especially things like renting an apartment are in jeopardy. So with that, and in the interest of time, I would just simply say thank you for your consideration, and we look forward to working on whatever needs to be resolved about this bill.
Is there an amendment in the works yet?
Pardon me?
Is there an amendment floated yet?
I do not have an amendment myself, yes.
Good afternoon, Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, and we understand the concerns, and we've had an opportunity to speak to Mr. Mullins, who, when I retire, I'll look different when I retire. We had a couple of concerns, and first, there isn't a real definition of contracting provider and non-contracting provider, and whether this bill would be for both provider types. We also understand that the rules are very clear that providers cannot and should not be billing Oregon Health Plan eligibility of patients. The way that it works is that we believe there is verification of eligibility at the front end, and that providers then can tell if the person is an OHP patient or not. They provide the service, and then they bill accordingly, either to the CCO or to the patient if the person was not eligible. What can happen is that it can be retroactive, and there may be some issues there with the retroactivity piece where OHA can come back and then says, yes, they actually did. In those cases, we feel the providers have done everything they can possibly do to make sure that they checked eligibility before. So there might be some system issues there that hopefully we can fix at some point. There are, I think there was some conversation about also that there are services that can be provided to OHP patients that are uncovered services, and that there's a whole form that the patient and the provider fill out. Once they fill out that form, then it is clear that the patient will be billed to by that provider because it is an uncovered service within Oregon Health Plan. So it doesn't talk about that in this bill, too, and we would want to clarify if that's still a concern, because we would obviously, if a patient wants to do something and can afford to do it and wants to pay for it, they should be allowed to. So those are just a few of our concerns, and we feel that there are rules and tools in the toolbox for OHA already in existence to combat this problem, but we'd be happy to discuss it further if we need to.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, and Nose, and members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. Our members are public agencies, private companies, and nonprofit organizations that provide 911 emergency transport throughout the state. And I think we would be happy to talk with Mr. Mullins about these issues. From our standpoint, it's mainly that our members think the system is currently working pretty well. Ambulance billing is complicated because they almost never know whether a patient is insured or not insured, and they are obligated, like ER physicians, to provide the service. But they find out as soon as they can whether a patient is Medicaid, and they say they are reimbursed by the CCO within 30 to 45 days, and they feel the system works pretty well. And they never send to collections unless it's 90 days. So we'd be happy to work with you. And we think the system works well, and they're nervous about changing it, is what I would say. Well, thank you.
I think this is a really important issue. We really want to make sure Medicaid patients, OHP patients, are protected. So if you guys could work together to get us whatever it takes to get this bill through.
Mr. Chair, I certainly would be happy to do so. And,
OHA in.
Exactly, yes.
Can
I ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I'm curious if we have a way of identifying who we might have as kind of frequent flyers. Do we have certain physician groups or certain issues with folks that continue to be repeat, I don't want to say offenders, but repeat folks that continue to bill and shouldn't be billing? Because that would be a red flag to me to say we might have an issue in their office. Having been on that side, to see that this happens really surprises me, because it really shouldn't. Mm-hmm. So from the coding perspective, and from when they come to the minute that they're processed through the door, there are so many safeguards in place that this really should not happen, having been on that side. So I would be curious as to whether or not you have the mechanism of seeing, are these folks the same ones over and over again? Is there a way to have a conversation or flag those to say something's not happening in this particular office? We need to see what's going on there. Is this a lot of people? Are we talking about a few?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hack, if I might, I think that's really an excellent question. We don't have information about all of the providers that have done this. We just know from our slice of what happens when people come to us because they're having problems. I think it would be helpful to see if there are entities that do this over and over again. We do know from, at least from our information, that it seems to be more frequent with fee-for-service clients as opposed to CCOs. But again, OHA would have that information, and I would think that it would be something OHA would want to do if there is a frequent flyer that makes this mistake over and over again, to counsel that provider about what they have signed up for and to be true to what's needed on behalf of the OHP clients.
We need to get them into the discussion.
Yeah, part just, of the issue just maybe is the an education.
And part of the issue is they're having trouble finding eligibility, and then they show up, and then they want to retroactively provide eligibility when people weren't eligible theoretically. They didn't know they were eligible at the time. It's a complicated. Let's get this settled, huh?
Yes, thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2398. I'm going to open up what is going to be a brief public hearing on House Bill 2664. You want to describe this bill for us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2664. Key sponsor is Representative Noson Lively. This bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules specifying the criteria for the licensing of extended stay centers. It also outlines the criteria to be contained in the rules, requires OHA and Department of Consumer and Business Services to convene a 9-member extended stay advisory group, specifies the membership of that group, directs OHA to report to the interim committee, the appropriate interim committee, no later than September 10th, 2022. And Mr. Chair, we have Doug Riggs, Marley Romanek, Dr. Mark, help me out here, Mark.
Fuglesong.
Thank you, Fuglesong.
It's my understanding that there's an amendment that will solve all the problems that we have general agreement. So let's have a brief hearing, and we'll bring you back when we have an amendment to talk about.
Well, then there's
Mr. Riggs, you kick it off.
We need to bring up Kevin Campbell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. I very much appreciate you taking the time, and we will take whatever limited time or no time whatsoever as you want, and I'm happy to yield my time, very little time. So we're in year three of having a discussion on this bill, and that's often the case with legislation. It takes a while for it to percolate and settle in. We had a bill in 2015 that we held a hearing in this very hearing room. We talked extensively during the interim on that bill. And then we went into a work group after the 2016 bill that Representative Nose helped us out with, and I have spoken directly with many of you. So I am going to flip through 90% of my slides, all of which are available online, and basically point you to two slides that I'd like you to take a look at, which kind of talk about the evidence that we've gathered to explore extended stay in Colorado. They call it convalescent care. But Both on cost comparisons, I won't go into any details, but you can see the costs for a similar surgery are much lower in this kind of a system. And the quality measures, all of which have been tracked very carefully, including infection rates, satisfaction, recovery, et cetera. But I really want to focus on what we have been doing in the last few months, if I can get our computer to cooperate. There we go. So as you recall, the original bill proposed that patients be allowed to stay in some sort of an extended stay setting for up to 72 hours beyond the 24 hours allowed in an ASC. So that was one of the main issues. We have, after long negotiations with a variety of the individuals and the organizations, agreed to a total of 48 hours in both facilities. So it could be 6 hours in one and 38 with my math. Yeah, that's right. 42 in the other. It could be, you know, 24 and 24, et cetera. But the goal is to limit it to a total of 24 hours. Now, there's one caveat, which is many patients for complicated surgeries are checked in at 6 a.m. in the morning. My members made a strong case that you wouldn't want to check like an elderly patient with their caregiver picking them up in the middle of rainy rush hour traffic at 6 a.m. So we built a safety valve in if there are some complications for a limited number of patients so we could add 4 hours. So we think that's reasonable. The number of centers, we originally had no cap on the proposal. We came back with a proposal of 25. And we went down to 15, and we agreed with many of the proprietors that it should be 16. The next issue was a key, who owns these things and who's involved. Many hospital organizations and health systems came in and said that they thought that it was important that there be some number set aside for joint ventures, and we ended up agreeing with them. If you look at the model in Colorado, this is the way it's worked out. About half of the ones in Colorado are joint ownership between a health system and an ASC. That makes sense. Having said that, we have many members in our association who are large enough to consider doing this without a joint venture, and so we've divided it 8 joint ventures, 5 non-joint ventures, and then 3 would be a first-come, first-serve. So that's we thought that was a reasonable compromise. Standards and metrics obviously are important. We want high standards, and we expect to work on that in the rulemaking committee. And then just a couple other issues. Medicare patients are limited in the reimbursement for extended stay, and many of the assisted living and the senior advocates wanted to make sure that we were very clear to Medicare patients exactly what was covered, so we'll cover that. There was a concern about out-of-state corporations coming in and setting up something, fly-by-night organizations, and so we require that any applicant must have experience in doing this. And then finally, there's a whole series of discussions that we had on how you get over CMS regulations at the federal level. And so there is a way to do this, as Colorado has done this with the Convalescent Care Center. It's a separate license at this point. Many of the organizations are similar organizations. They have many of the same board of directors. But there's a way to get around it and comply with CMS law that's done in Colorado.
I just wrap it up.
Yeah. The last thing is we would like to see a single license, and we think that with the new administration that they're going to be very amenable to that type of thing. So that in a nutshell, is the agreement.
And you have an amendment that puts all these things in place that's coming, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, it's down at Legislative Council right now. I anticipate it will be back at some point, and we'll probably have to do some fine-tuning on the amendment, but we're optimistic. As you can see from the list of supporters, it's a broad list of supporters. We've been trying to talk to all of the people who had concerns. I think we are a long ways down that path.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
Chairman Greenlick, representatives and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today for House Bill 2664. I am the nurse administrator at Willamette Surgery Center. My name is Marilyn Romanek, and I've had the pleasure of working there for almost 18 years, providing excellent care with other nurses and the physicians that I work with. In that time, an average of 3,500 to 3,600 patients per year, so over 60,000 patients in that time. And in the last couple of years, we have expanded our services to include total joint replacements, knees, hips, and some shoulders at, as Doug pointed out, a large reduction in cost to those patients without compromising their care, the quality of their care, their outcomes, and giving them excellent patient experience. So I would just like to have the extended care to be able to provide those kinds of services for more patients who maybe don't have the social support at home. The patients that we do now have good support at home and are able to leave within 24 hours, but there's a lot of patients out there that meet our selection criteria that just don't have someone at home that could take care of them on day one. And if they were allowed to stay for another day or two, we would be able to provide those excellent services to a lot more of the population in our area.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm Mark Fogelsong. I am a practicing orthopedic surgeon here in Salem and at Willamette Surgery Center, and I would just echo what you've already heard, and I appreciate your endurance at sitting through long hours of testimony. This is impressive. I have recently been on the receiving
end. You even have an orthopedic surgeon who does that.
I've recently been on the receiving end of orthopedic surgery at an inpatient setting. which I thought could be done as an outpatient setting, and then I got the bill. And so I am now acutely aware of the costs, even more so than before. And I think that the quality is certainly there at the inpatient side of things, and I think that we can match that very well with at outpatient centers, and the efficiency is higher, and our outcome measurements are at least as good. So I think reducing that cost and increasing the value is a great way to go. And if we can provide that to more patients and save more healthcare dollars, then I think we'll be better stewards of the healthcare dollars. And I would like to field any questions that anybody has.
Thank you very much. We have one more witness to bring.
Actually, two.
Two more.
Tom Lorish, Dr. Tom Lorish, Kevin Campbell. Do you want to hear from the agency, from the OHA?
No.
Okay. There you go.
I don't even want to hear from Campbell. Well.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dr. Tom Lorish. I serve as Medical Director of Orthopedics and Ambulatory Surgery and Chief Executive of Outreach and Strategic Affiliation for Providence Health Services in Oregon. I am here today to share our support for House Bill 2664 with some forthcoming amendments. In addition to our 8 hospitals and 54 clinics, Providence is a joint venture partner in 5 ambulatory surgery centers. Through our partnerships, we've expanded the ability to serve patients with high-quality care in a low-cost setting. Not every patient nor every surgery is appropriate for an ASC setting, but with increasing technology, we are able to care for an increasing number of patients with this model. With the proper oversight, we believe that ambulatory surgery centers with extended care facilities will further the goal of the triple aim. Providence worked closely with the ASC Association in search of a bill we could support. Some of the key points of the agreement include, I won't go into the licensing issue. I think that's been covered. From an entity structure standpoint, because extended stay centers will enable ASCs to see patients of a higher acuity and stay for longer periods of time, it's our belief that these entities will produce better outcomes and quality when partnered with a healthcare system. In addition, from a health system standpoint, there are 2 key advantages from a plan standpoint. It's a lower cost setting and a lower cost for high quality care, which we think is important as we try to decrease the or bend the cost curve in healthcare. And from a hospital perspective, we believe that we can drive hospital volume into these ambulatory surgery centers, not have to build so many hospitals, and use those hospital beds to a higher purpose. We believe that's a much more effective use. Just like as a physician, I wish to work at my highest level of licensure. We'd like our hospitals to do the same and drive volume off to a higher level of licensure, if you will, to the ambulatory surgery setting. Achieving the triple aim and pursuing population health strategies require hospitals and health systems to think differently about how to deliver care to patients. As a fully integrated healthcare delivery system, Providence views ASC's extended care centers as a way to further improve the delivery of care and reduce cost. And done correctly, these new centers will not act as a threat to hospitals, but enable patients to be seen in the right setting, reserving hospital care for the sickest and most vulnerable patients. Thank you for the opportunity to share our support of House Bill 2664 with amendments. I'm happy to answer questions you might have.
Thank you. No questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, including the Oregon 62 acute care hospitals and the patients they serve. I'll tell you up front, the original bill we're in opposition to, and so we're looking forward to the amendments. And we do know that one of our health systems, Providence, has been in active negotiation with the Ambulatory Surgical Center Association, and that I know a lot of the concerns that we've expressed in a number of meetings that have occurred over the last few years, as Mr. Riggs has mentioned, our concerns, there would be no surprise if I mentioned them. The lens we're looking through as we evaluate the amendments would include things like certificate of need, in the sense that obviously there are different types of models of care around the state, and depending on where you are, this fits or doesn't fit, depending on the needs there. Access to care has continued to be an issue, and so we're looking at that carefully to make sure that access to care is preserved. Expanded patient safety protocols in an environment where you're expanding the hours to 48 hours. We want to make sure that those are taken seriously, and that as the hours increase,
the appropriate protocols are also recognized. For instance, OHA just increased our requirements for facilities this last year for our hospital outpatient satellite facilities that go beyond 24 hours for some patients. So there are a number of issues that we're looking at, and we'll look forward to seeing the amendments. And at that time, we'll weigh in as a constructive partner to see where we can get. But I appreciate the committee's time this afternoon and appreciate the work of Providence and others to make sure this works well for the state. Thank you.
Keep in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2664, and I'm going to reopen both of the other two public hearings. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2432 and House Bill 2723. We've heard what those bills are. I'm going to alternate panels of these two bills until we run out of time, so please keep it under 2 minutes. Panel.
I'll start with House Bill 2432. The first panel is Mary Andrus, Jolie Guillemot, Sally Giles.
That's it.
On deck will be for 2723 Jason Burge and Ruth Blakely. Thank you. That's it. There's only two on the second one.
The only two on it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, Representative Hayden, the rest of the committee. Thank you for this time and allowing us the opportunity to talk. My name is Mary Andrus. I am the program director representing of the Art Therapy Counseling Program at Merrillhurst University in Lake Oswego. And I had submitted my testimony ahead of time. Hopefully you had a chance to read it. In addition, a letter, 31 letters of endorsement and two articles about art therapy and its impact. I think bottom line is we would like for the practice of art therapy to be done with by people who are licensed, and that's what we're hoping to achieve with this license. I'm the former president of the Illinois Art Therapy Association. I'm a proud member of the American Art Therapy Association, where we have 5,500 practitioners, educators, researchers that are engaged in the art therapy profession. I'm working on my doctorate in art therapy, and I think this field is growing, and it's going to continue to grow, and we need to have these benchmarks of professional practice in order to elevate the field to the next level. In passing this bill, it will help protect the clients, the people who are receiving the art therapy services, and that's our goal, is we want to have people who are serving the clients to be meeting the most highest ethical level of professional practice, and that the clients are not being harmed by someone attempting to do art therapy when they really aren't trained in the field as art therapists. That's the bottom line.
Thank you very much.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jolie Guillemot, and I am an art therapy graduate student at Merrillhurst University. I graduate in June of 2017. And prior to this, I had been an art teacher for several years, including in Portland Public Schools or Portland Parks and Education and out of my private studio. But I chose to become an art therapist because I recognized the limitations of what I was able to accomplish. And I wanted to serve my students at the time in a better way. So I've invested a lot of time and energy and loss of sleep in order to get this graduate degree. And this part of this degree requires 720 hours of client contact. And I'm currently working at a psychiatric day treatment center in Tigard with a very vulnerable population, children ages 4 to 12, who are experiencing traumatic brain injury or have a diagnosis of autism. And in my very limited experience, I've already seen examples of misinformed teachers or therapists harming children through improper use of some of these methods or practices. And as an intern, there are only so many things I can do to protect them. But I'm hoping that with the passage of this bill, that you'll be able to help us to protect these kids. And I thank you for your time and the work that you do for the people of Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Sally Giles, and I'm an art therapist and licensed counselor. I've been practicing art therapy since 2002, and I've worked with a wide range of populations, but the largest amount of experience I have is working with older adults in long-term care communities. Art therapy is particularly powerful for this population. Being able to express things that are beyond words through visual means is something that really helps people in powerful ways. As people are facing mortality, as people are facing chronic illness or multiple losses, art therapy allows people to gain insight and find meaning in their pain and confusion, or become more engaged in their lives and find healing and peace. Art therapy is also incredibly helpful for people who are experiencing neurocognitive impairments, such as Alzheimer's disease. These illnesses prevent people from being able to understand the world around them the way they used to, and prevent them from being able to express their experience of that. And art therapy gives them a way to express themselves beyond words. The relief and the excitement that I've experienced when connecting with people who are experiencing neurocognitive impairments and helping them find alternatives and supplements to verbal communication are among my most meaningful life experiences. In the field of care for older adults, the arts are becoming more and more popular. There are tons of wonderful programs out there using professional artists, creating intergenerational programs, many different programs based in different art media. And these are wonderful things that art therapists love to see. But they also create some confusion and make it hard for people to understand what is art therapy and what isn't art therapy. The retirement community where I work now, when I first started working there, I saw on their activity calendar that they offered art therapy. And I was so excited and intrigued by this until I realized it was simply a craft group led by someone who did not study art therapy and who was just leading everyone through making the same uniform project. And certainly the participants enjoyed that experience, but it was not art therapy. Art therapy is conducted by people who have been trained at the master's level or higher. Art therapists obtain informed consent. They evaluate the strengths and needs of those they work with to create a treatment plan and encourage meaningful self-expression rather than uniform projects. Art therapists use their training with a wide range of art materials and processes to sensitively individualize their interventions. Art therapists combine counseling skills and knowledge of the evocative properties of different art materials to maintain therapeutic safety. And finally, art therapists can elicit creative engagement from individuals who do not identify as artists and may not otherwise seek out beneficial creative opportunities. So in conclusion, art therapy is a distinct profession. It offers unique mental health and wellness benefits for a wide range of populations, including older adults and those experiencing memory loss. An art therapy license will help protect the public by clarifying the difference between art therapy and other arts programming. And recognition with a state license will help increase awareness and availability of this valuable profession to those who can benefit the most. Thank you.
Very much.
Can I make one more quick statement?
Very brief.
Okay. We have expectation that in order to become credentialed, you need to complete 1,000 hours of client contact with 100 hours of supervised work after completing your master's degree, and that will be the entry-level license if this bill is passed. So it provides a level of competence that an oversight that would be required in order to get the entry level bubble of the license.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Would you call the next panel on the other bill, please? It'll be the last
Jason
panel
Birch
on that bill.
And Ruth Blakely.
Good afternoon, Chair
Greenlick.
That's okay. I'll take care of that.
Thank
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ruth Dismuke Blakely. I'm a speech-language pathologist, actually from Skyline Therapy Services in Edgewood, New Mexico. And I'm here also representing the American Hippotherapy Association, as is Steve McKenzie, who is the current president of the American Hippotherapy Association. HP 2723 seeks to remove hippotherapy as an excluded service. And my role here is to give you some clarity on what hippotherapy is and what it is not. First of all, it is not a service. Hippotherapy simply refers to when equine movement is included as a treatment tool within the scope of a physical therapy, occupational therapy, or speech and language therapy plan of care. It's basically using the movement, the multidimensional movement of the horse, to facilitate the neuromotor systems that support human function, that help us walk and talk and use our hands and attend, and a variety of other things. Since it's not a separate form of therapy, there are no hippotherapists. It is simply a scope of practice tool recognized by the American Physical Therapy, the American Occupational Therapy, and the American Speech and Language Hearing Associations as part of what we do as PTs, OTs, and SLP professionals. And it's sort of misrepresented right now. It's understandable that there's confusion about it, but that, again, is my role to try to clarify it. I think there's a lot of times a concern that a tool like this that appears to be very different might add money or cost to the healthcare system, but in fact, that's not the case, because hippotherapy is not done in isolation, but is done in conjunction with your other treatment tools and strategies. It falls right within the regular fee structure. Therapists are accountable to incorporate it with their other tools and strategies, and it's, for some people, it is a highly effective treatment tool in helping them reach their full functional outcomes. Another area of concern has been whether or not it is experimental or investigational. First of all, you should know that within the healthcare system and within the third-party reimbursement system, there is no standard for what represents no longer being investigational. It's a little bit of an arbitrary designation. To date, you were all sent around a bibliography, and to date there are at least 52 peer-reviewed journal articles in well-recognized journals that are on that bibliography. As a matter of fact, Colorado State University has just completed a systematic mapping study where they have now identified 88 peer-reviewed journal articles substantiating the use or the validity of incorporating equine movement into a therapy plan of care.
Ask you to wrap up.
Yes, sir. Just want to go on record as saying that it is medical need that drives whether or not a child or an adult gets physical, occupational, or speech therapy, and this is just one of the tools that can be highly effective in addressing the needs of our populations with special needs.
Thank you. If you wait a minute, if you stay right there, I need to pause to do a bit of business before I lose the quorum here. I'm going to open up a work session for the purpose of introducing a committee bill. Do I have a motion?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill, LC 1940, dated October 7th, 2016.
Representative Noakes moves that LC be admitted as a committee bill, as noted. Is there any objection? So moved. Close your work session. That didn't take long. Your turn.
Thank you, sir. Chair Greenlick, members of the Healthcare Committee. My name is Jason Burge, and I'm the Executive Director of Forward Stride, a therapeutic equestrian center in Beaverton, Washington County. The Oregon Health Plan currently excludes hippotherapy as a treatment tool in physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech and language therapy, despite the existence of more than 80 peer-based research studies which demonstrate the effectiveness of using equine movements in these therapy sessions. Removing this exclusion from OHP will benefit our most vulnerable citizens, such as Oregon's 7,500 foster youth, daily foster youth, and over 247,000 returning military veterans. Because it will help ensure access to this tool, which would otherwise need to be paid out of pocket. Removing the word hippotherapy from the OHP will encourage other centers and clinics like ours to serve these citizens better, because all citizens deserve access to the health care that works for them. In closing, at bottom line, this is going to allow people an option that could really benefit them. There's no requirements. It doesn't add anything to any additional bills, but it would allow people that don't have, that are already underserved, to have an option to serve and have a treatment tool that could really benefit them. That concludes my remarks, and I welcome any questions. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I appreciate your clarifying this thing for us, I think.
It is a bit confusing sometimes.
It's much clearer now what we're talking about.
Yes, sir.
Yes, please go ahead.
Mr. Greenlick, I'm Steve McKenzie. I'm just here to answer questions that you might have, and as Ruth and Jason have testified.
Well, I think the clarification that we're just talking about this as a therapy inside other therapies seems mm-hmm. to
yes, sir.
Make it a lot easier for us to understand.
Oh.
Your other vice chair has a question.
Oh. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Just very quick comment and support. When Chair Greenlick scheduled this bill, I asked permission to bring my daughter, who has special needs, her pony here. He gave me permission, but I feared that facilities would have declined such that activity. So I'll just share with you a picture.
Awesome.
In all seriousness, this is something that we should very seriously consider as an opportunity to engage folks that it is difficult for our medical community to engage with. And so I don't want to take up a whole bunch of time, but I want our panel to look at this from a serious aspect of a real medical therapy that can be provided. I see it in my family, I see it in others, and I hope we can take a serious concern about it.
Thank you
very much.
May I add a small comment to that? It's not a miracle cure, but for many of the clients, the populations that we serve, equine movement has actually been the tool that helped them to regain walking or say their first words or overcome feeding difficulties because of its powerful impact on the human core postural system.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2723. Call the next panel.
We're back on 2432, art therapy. Beth Ann Short, Francis Griffin, Elizabeth Remley.
We only have two more after this panel, so if you're all brief, we'll have time. We'll hang in with you and make sure everybody gets heard. But quickly. Thank you very much. I know you guys come a long way, and I really appreciate it. I'm sorry we have to hold you down, but
it's okay.
Too much of a good thing can be a lot of it.
Why don't you guys want to be good?
Okay. Chair Greenlick, members of the Committee on Health Care, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and provide testimony. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Great. My name is Frances Griffith. I'm a registered board-certified art therapist. I'm here from Benton County today. I've worked as an art therapist for a few years now, since 2013, and also as much as a researcher, both here in the States and also abroad in Tanzania and East Africa. And I brought some art for you all to look at today as I echo and underscore the points of the previous testimony that you heard. I've got a couple pieces from secondary school students in Tanzania, and I'd chiefly like to give support of the bill when speaking about specialized training of art therapists and how it will be better for the protection of the public if the term art therapy services and art therapist is reserved exclusively for licensed art therapists who do have that master's level training and postgraduate experience. Because we have training that overlaps with other clinicians, and also as the other folks who gave testimony said, it overlaps with even commercial artists and also art educators, I want to emphasize our training that is specialized to art therapy, specifically therapeutic use of art materials. There are some materials that can even be hazardous when they are used in certain situations, and we are trained to judge what's the best material to use. For example, in this piece, you can see that rigid and structured materials can give you more information from someone. There's something that can be simple, can get you a detailed representation across. I've seen personally how when someone uses more evocative or fluid materials, if they've recently had a crisis, if they're experiencing strong emotions, maybe if they're floridly psychotic, that it can make those things worse. And that's training that we have. To keep it brief, another couple areas that we have specialized training in, unique to art therapy, would be ethical considerations about artwork as protected health information, just like other clinicians consider statements, diagnoses as protected health information. So even making the decision about what to bring here today to show you, which is less sensitive artwork, it might be in an art show, in an educational presentation. That's training that we have. And finally, I'd like to speak to the fact that every graduate art therapy program is required to have multicultural training with respect to art therapy, which is important with diverse clientele. Even with this artwork in Tanzania, we seek informed consent and also consent for clients to waive part of their confidentiality whenever they show artwork. But with other cultures, that might look differently. Here in the States, we talk to children and their parents. But in East Africa, you talk to the entire school, the teachers and the principal as a group, as a more communal culture. So it's training like that in multicultural awareness, therapeutic use of art materials, and ethical considerations with artwork that help us be able to be especially trained to provide art therapy services. Thank you for this opportunity, and I'm available for questions after these ladies speak.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Great. Chair Greenlick and the rest of the committee, I'm Beth Ann Short. I've been practicing art therapy since 1999, so I'm obviously looking for House Bill 2432 to be passed. I won't speak and repeat things, but I will tell you a little bit about clients I've seen because it is different than you've already heard about. I've worked in juvenile justice. I've worked in foster care, and currently in my private practice, I work with a number of adults with disability, different intellectual disabilities. I've provided you with some handouts that talk in detail about what I do as Open Studio, so you'll see the clinical spectrum of what I do in your handouts. And also, I had authorization from a client to show you as a number one piece of art first session, and then a final session from 6 months later, so you can see some pretty significant growth in her development. And I talk more about her in my testimony that you have. And then finally, there's even more places to practice art therapy. So there's a nice outline for you to see the diversity and the broad spectrum of our facets. So I'm also available for questions if you have any. But again, I don't want to take up all your time. I know you're super.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of COPACT, which is the Professional Association for Licensed Professional Counselors and Marriage and Family Therapists. We've been working with the proponents of the Art Therapy Licensure Bill and also with the Psychologists Association to come up with a couple of really simple amendments that Rep. Parrish alluded to earlier. COPACT is supportive of a licensing bill for art therapists. Art therapists are an important part of the mental health provider community in Oregon. And we just want to make sure that the bill reflects that a licensed professional in a mental health space can use art in their therapy without being in violation of the art therapy license. And so we're going to make sure that there's an exemption in the requirements for an art therapy license for other licensed mental health practitioners.
You've got that amendment coming.
Yes, it's been requested to LC. And then the Psychologist Association has also requested a couple of other very minor language changes, and we've been in touch with Annette Shore out of Merrillhurst to make sure that those language changes are okay, and it sounds like they are, so we'll have that amendment for you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
The last panel, please.
The last individual is Sylvie Donaldson.
Just one.
Just right. One.
We're almost done.
Which bill is this for?
This is still the art there. The people therapy, we completed their sign up.
Hello, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Sylvie Donaldson, the Director for the Health Licensing Office.
Oh, that's right.
While the office is neutral on this bill, I'm here to talk about the impact of 2432. The bill creates a license to practice art therapy. This bill's license would be administered as a program and not as a board, which is easier and less expensive to administer because there's going to be a small number of licensees, as far as I'm understanding. In addition, the bill clearly states the qualifications needed for the license, the fact that it's a practice act, and creates some exemptions. This makes rule writing really easy to administer and pretty straightforward. The bill has, the verbiage of the bill was worked with on with us for, in the office, which is very similar, as you heard before, to the music therapy program. So,
you feel comfortable being able to manage it?
Yes.
Well, thank you for sitting in all this time. To
listen. You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you all. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2432. And we'll be working these bills as we get amendments. We have amendments on all the bills, and we'll be discussing it for work session later. I thank you all that have come in this whole period with us. We've done very well. I'm sorry I've been a little pushy, but we actually got through it all. We are adjourned.
Nicely done.
We are adjourned.